I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, analysis of the new National Intelligence Estimate that concludes that Iran has frozen its nuclear weapons program. But first, President Bush spent most of the morning's news conference answering questions about the new NIE. It reverses the 2005 report that said Iran was bent on producing nuclear weapons. The new report says Iran halted its secret nuclear weapons program in 2003 under international pressure, but also says Iran could still produce a nuclear bomb by 2010 to 2015 if the program is reinstated. But the report stands in stark contrast to the president's own rhetoric. At his last news conference in October, he said people interested in avoiding World War III should be working to prevent Iran from having the knowledge needed to make a nuclear weapon. Today, he said the new report doesn't change anything.
What's to say they couldn't start another covert nuclear weapons program? And the best way to ensure that the world is peaceful in the future is for the international community to continue to work together to say to the Iranians, you know, we're going to isolate you.
John Ward covers the White House for the Washington Times. He was at today's news conference. John, the president was asked directly whether he now faces a credibility gap with the American people. What did he say?
Hi, Robin. Yeah, the president said he does not believe there's a credibility gap. His national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, said the same thing. And that's because they don't believe their rhetoric referring to such things as World War III is any different from what they're saying now, which is still that Iran is a threat because they want to obtain nuclear weapons. Their only real change in this report, I think from the White House perspective, is that they had this program and it was stopped in 2003. So we're dealing a little bit with two different issues, one of capability in Iran and one of intent. And I think in terms of capability, there's been some change in the analysis. As far as intent goes, there doesn't seem to be much change from either the NIE. The Bush administration certainly doesn't think there's any change in Iran's intent to obtain weapons.
I was going to ask, is that the Bush administration's take on it? Well, there's been talk about debate within the Bush administration about military action against Iran. Was the president asked about that?
He was asked at one point if military action was off the table, and he did not answer it. It wasn't really pressed upon him, so he got away with really just that one question. I'm sure he would answer, however, that it's not off the table because I think his philosophy is that it should never be off the table.
What about diplomacy and negotiations with Iran? Was the president asked if he'd, you know, reconsider them given this report?
Yeah, I mean, he has continued to say that this is a time for the international community to continue to press Iran for diplomatic talks as long as they promise to stop enriching uranium and pursuing a nuclear weapon. He also pointed back to the talks in, I believe, 2003. He said that the U.S. supported the talks with Germany, France, and Britain with Iran, and that the U.S. is totally open to the diplomatic option as long as Iran makes a promise to stop pursuing weapons.
And, of course, this new report says that it finds that Iran still is enriching uranium, but for civilian purposes. There are other topics in the 45-minute news conference. By the way, did the president say when he found out about the information from this report? Because the news conference was called after another appearance yesterday, sort of blasting Congress, and we want to get to his what he had to say about other topics. But did he say when he found out about the information in this report?
He did. He said he found out last week. He said that Director of National Intelligence Mike McConnell came into his office and briefed him last week. He was also asked, let me back up. National Security Advisor Hadley yesterday.
Stephen Hadley, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said yesterday that the president was told about this, I think a couple weeks ago, was his exact quote. The president acknowledged that McConnell had come in August and told him they had some new information. The president, however, said that he was not told the nature of the new information. And actually, that was one of the – I didn't get to ask a question today. That was one of the questions I wanted to ask is, was there no indication of the nature of the information given to him by McConnell in August? But anyway, he said that he was told about it, this report, last week, and there's been a lot of talk about the nature of the press briefing today, because usually they announce these things the day of the press briefing. Yesterday they announced this a day in advance, so it was clearly an attempt or an opportunity for the Bush administration to give their spin of this report. And I actually have wondered if they are even happy that this report came out. I've talked to the DNI's office about whether or not the White House has control over the release of these reports, and the DNI spokesman maintain that they are independent and they release these reports independent of the White House. Mm-hmm.
Well, as we said, prior to, you know, at least public knowledge of this report coming out, there was a presidential sort of assault on Congress yesterday, scolding them for sending him bills they'd know he will veto. Then, as we said, this press conference was called for today. Did he continue that attack on Congress?
He did, but, I mean, it was basically just a prelude to the talks and the questions and answers about Iran.
Mm-hmm.
His reference to bills being passed that Congress knew would be vetoed was a reference to the SCHIP bill, the Children's Health Insurance bill. Right now, he's calling for Congress to pass a $196 billion war supplemental before they leave for Christmas. Congress, as far as my reporting goes, does not have a set date for when they go home for Christmas. It could be 2 weeks, could be 3 weeks. I believe we have 3 weeks until Christmas. And so he's calling for that primarily. He also wants them to pass intelligence reform without penalizing telecommunications companies. He wants them to fix the alternative minimum tax so that it doesn't hit the middle class, and he wants them to pass 11 remaining appropriations bills.
But as you said, you know, the topic du jour became the new national intelligence estimate, especially since it so contrasts with the last report of 2005. And it seems to contrast with what the Bush administration has been saying about Iran's weapons program. How did he seem to you today, John Ward?
He seemed very animated, or he was very animated, and I think at times he appeared to be a bit defensive, because there is an appearance here, at least just from the initial first blush of this report, that there's a change. And I think, though, that some of us are scratching our heads trying to figure out what exactly the change is from 2005. I actually am trying to go back and look at what was said in 2005. The 2005 report was never released. According to the DNI's office, the only things that have been said about it were statements to Congress in 2007. So there needs to be some looking at that.
Well, I tell you what, we have an analyst who's going to do just that, and there are people who see very clear differences between the two reports. So we're going to take a closer look now. John Ward, having covered the president's press conference this morning in Washington for The Washington Times. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure. Thanks, Robin.
Well, for more on the national intelligence estimate on Iran, we want to turn to Eric Rosenbach. Until recently, he was Republican Senator Chuck Hagel's national security advisor. He also worked on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And Eric, do you see differences between the 2005 and 2007 reports?
Yeah, the differences are very clear. And in fact, the assessment that was released yesterday turned the 2005 assessment on its head. The opening line of the assessment that was released yesterday said that, in fact, the Iranians had foregone a weapons program in 2003, which is exactly the opposite of what the assessment in 2005 said.
In fact, the New York Times writes in its analysis, its opening line, rarely, if ever, has a single intelligence report so completely, so suddenly, and so surprisingly altered a foreign policy debate here. Your take on that sentence?
That's exactly right. First, it completely pulls the rug out from underneath the Bush administration strategy they've had regarding Iran. The Bush administration strategy has focused on taking a hard line and focusing on the issue that the Iranians were pursuing a nuclear weapon. If that's no longer true, the context in which they're operating has completely changed. Just imagine for a second, if you can, the Iranian negotiator holding up the American intelligence estimate over his head, waving it at the other negotiators and saying, see, I told you so. We were telling you the truth the entire time. We only have a peaceful nuclear program.
Well, but does the president have a point? Because in the comments that we just heard from today and in his comments from October, where he used the phrase World War III, he said the knowledge of making a weapon. Iran, if Iran has the knowledge of making a weapon, they are a danger.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a very important distinction to make in looking at the president's language. He did say the knowledge. I think that, first of all, it's important because the president probably did know about the new intelligence reports when he made that statement, because he was careful to distinguish between the knowledge. It's also important to recognize that when building a nuclear weapon, a lot of it is the intellectual capital involved in developing and enriching uranium. So although the Iranians don't have a weapons program right now, by continuing with their enrichment program, they would be taking a step forward to building a weapon if they wanted to do that.
So what do you make of that? I mean, just in your opinion, is, you say, and the Times says, everyone says it changes the foreign policy debate. We hear, you know, the president, who one would think is leading the foreign policy debate, he hasn't changed it at all. So in at least in this moment, in your sense, does that report say that there should be a debate change?
I think the report strongly indicates that if the United States thinks very rational about this, it's clear that we need a strategy change regarding Iran. You cannot continue on the way forward when there's been such a dramatic change in the context. It should probably look something like this. We should build on the negotiations that we've had with the Iranians in Baghdad, which have led to some successes in stemming the flow of weapons coming across the border into Iraq. You could build on that success by opening up the negotiations with the Iranians on a whole host of subjects. The most problematic part of the Bush strategy right now is that he has set the precondition that we will not negotiate with Iran on the nuclear program, civilian or otherwise, until they stop enrichment. It's putting the cart before the horse, and what you want is to be able to talk about that issue in a way that's constructive and hopefully lead to the point where the Iranians are more open to oversight.
Yeah, because just to remind people, we're going pretty quickly through this, but they claim that they are enriching the uranium for use in the civilian energy program as opposed to the weapons program. But
right.
You need a certain amount of enriched uranium to build a weapon.
That's so exactly right.
The
right.
More they do that, the more they work on that, the more, and this is what it seems the president is saying.
That's right.
So what's the argument against that? I mean, isn't he right that the more they keep enriching uranium, if they once had the intent but stopped in 2003, why can't they just start it again?
And the president's point is right. The intellectual capital that you gain through that could be used for a weapons program. But what you have to think is you want to try to alter the Iranian intent. And if you push them into a corner with bellicose language and threats of strong sanctions, then you're not going to get to the point where they do not want a nuclear weapons program, which is where you ultimately want to be.
That's Eric Rosenbach. Until recently, Republican Senator Chuck Hagel's national security advisor. He also has other roles in analysis of nuclear weapons programs. We'll tell you more about that when we come back. And we'll continue our conversation. I want to know, Eric, why this change? What do you think that means, that there's this big reversal in the national intelligence estimate? We'll do that in 1 minute. Later in the program, the people who bring you your mail, we're going to take a few minutes for them as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with Eric Rosenbach, Executive Director for Research at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Until recently, he was Republican Senator Chuck Hagel's National Security Advisor. He also served on the Senate Intelligence Committee in a professional capacity.
That's right, as a professional staff member.
And didn't you also author some of the pre-war intelligence on Iraq?
That's right. I authored the report assessing the connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and we found that there were very few, if any. And also the most recent report that we released this spring about pre-war intelligence assessments about the post-war situation in Iraq.
Well, then you better than anybody know that Americans are very skittish when it comes to intelligence reports, because the intelligence that provoked or took the U.S. into the war in Iraq proved to be false. Your report was not paid much attention to. And now we have a complete reversal in 2 years in reports on Iran. We're talking about the National Intelligence Estimate in 2005 saying with high confidence that Iran was bent on a nuclear weapons program and was working on it. Now saying in 2007 with high confidence, and I'm going to read from the report, a judge with high confidence that in fall of 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program. Why should we trust any of this? Why, if the report was so wrong in 2005, why can't this 2007 be wrong too?
It's right to always be somewhat skeptical of intelligence if you're a policymaker or if you're an American citizen. In this case, I think, however, that the intelligence community has done a good job and learned from some of the mistakes that they made about Iraq in the last NIE. But here's the major point that you need to consider. In such a spectacular change of assessment, the most likely scenario is that the intelligence community has gained new insight, new information, new sources on the Iranian decision-making process and circles regarding the weapons program.
You're saying maybe there's people on the ground that there weren't before infiltrating the program?
There could be something like that. I don't know anything for certain about those sources, but that's something that could be. It could be new signals intelligence from communications. It could be an asset. But there's something new and very strong that has caused them to completely change this assessment. Another thing to keep in mind is that it's not completely out of the blue that the Iranians have given up the nuclear weapons program. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has said for the past 2 years that there was no evidence of an Iranian nuclear weapons program. The Russian intelligence service has also publicly said that over the last 2 years. So I think in this case, it's probably a pretty good bet that the intelligence community has a good assessment.
As you were just saying a few minutes ago, you're one that would say that an interpretation of this report is that the U.S. should begin opening new channels, diplomacy, talks, to try to, you know, work with Iran in this opening. But I can hear people in the Bush administration saying our belligerence, our threats are exactly why Iran stopped the program. Why do you, first of all, how would you interpret it?
It's a good point, and I'm sure that you will hear from the administration and others that part of the reason that the Iranians decided to give up their nuclear program, the weapons program in 2003, is because we invaded Iraq, that served as the major deterrent that moved Libya away from its program, the Iranians as well. There's some truth to that. Deterrence is always helpful when negotiating. But when you're trying to alter a nation's intents when they don't have a weapons program, belligerent language is not the way to go. And you can negotiate from a position of strength, but the negotiations aspect is the key. You sit down, you try to work out your differences and build on common interests, of which we have some with Iran.
Weren't there also intelligence reports, and perhaps you authored one of them, that said before the war in Iraq that the war in Iraq would be dangerous because it would provoke neighboring countries like Iran to, you're nodding yes, it might have been you,
yeah,
to build a nuclear weapons program. And it appears as if the opposite has happened.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The intelligence assessments completed before the war in 2003 said that by going to war with Iraq, we actually would increase the likelihood that nations in the region would ramp up their WMD programs. And that, until now, had always seemed like a good logical assessment. It seems as though that's not correct.
And why would you think it wouldn't be? I mean, why would Iraq with a destabilized, I mean, Iran rather, pardon me, why would Iran with a destabilized Iraq right over the border suddenly decide not to build its nuclear weapons?
Well, it's a good
program.
Question, but you have to think from the Iranian perspective, and it's very important. Iran very likely constructed its WMD program with the idea that they needed to protect themselves from Saddam Hussein and Iraq, not from the United States. Their arch rival and enemy and national security threat has been Iraq. If that enemy is suddenly removed, that will have the major factor in changing your calculus on whether you need a WMD program or not.
No. So perhaps the U.S. did Iran a favor in some way. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the
That's
future
right.
in Iraq.
Yeah. And remember in 2003, too, that we were actually negotiating with the Iranians about Afghanistan, and there was a friendlier relationship. It wasn't belligerent.
So Eric Rosenbach, what do you think happens now when it comes to sanctions, when it comes to whether or not this White House in particular will be able to have more diplomatic relations with Iran?
From what the president said today, it doesn't look like the administration plans for a change of course in their strategy. This will make it extremely difficult to work with the Europeans, especially with the Russians and the Chinese, to try to bring Iran closer to the international community. And I suspect that unless the administration really changes that perspective, that we won't make much progress.
Well, and I'm wondering about that because Kenneth Pollack, the former CIA agent and foreign policy observer, said that Iran's got two components, hardliners and pragmatists. This report that claims that the Iran nuclear weapons program has been frozen could mean that the pragmatists are winning out in Iran. Does President Bush risk losing the opportunity to support them if he doesn't take up diplomacy?
I think it's important to note that there are two distinct opinions in Iran, and that right now there's a lot of public opinion building against President Ahmadinejad and the more conservative elements about the nuclear program. If you were to open up negotiations, you may open an opportunity for that domestic, more moderate audience to have more influence and result in a change of power that would be beneficial for the United States.
That's Eric Rosenbach, Executive Director for Research at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, also was an advisor to Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, and was on the Senate Intelligence Committee as a professional, as a civilian, and also authored some pre-war intelligence in the run-up to the war in Iraq, saying there was no relation between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. And we appreciate your time here today taking a look at the new national estimate on intelligence.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Stay with us. We'll be back in after the news, taking a look at treating water to bolster the supply of drinking water. That's still to come here and now. Orange County in Southern California is about to turn on what industry experts say is the world's largest plant devoted to purifying sewer water to increase drinking water supplies. The new $481 million plant could serve as a model for water authorities facing persistent drought everywhere. But sewage to drinking water, detractors call it toilet to tap. Can the industry overcome a suspicion that this is just not a good thing? Well, supporters, and our next guest is one of them, say that the plan isn't as direct as toilet to tap. And anyway, it's very safe. Savaji Deshmukh is the project manager for the Orange County Water District. He joins us from his office in Fountain Valley, California. Savaji, explain, toilet to tap, that's not how your plant works, right?
No, actually, that phrase is a misnomer. What we're actually doing here is we're purifying highly treated wastewater that's normally discharged to the ocean. We're sending it through three major processes on the water district side. And then after we produce this near-distilled quality water, we're actually putting it back in the ground where it'll stay for a few years. Ultimately, it'll be reused by the citizens of North and Central Orange County, but it is not going directly to the tap.
You put the water into aquifers, an underground area, and then it makes its way back into the processing?
Ultimately, the cities will pump that water out of the ground and then put it into their city distribution systems.
Well, this is a process that's used by only about a dozen agencies in the U.S. And in fact, I think Namibia, the capital of Namibia, is the only place that actually uses what's called toilet to tap. They put recycled water directly into the tap water distribution system. But still in all, I mean, how do people react to this idea that this is sewage that's, even though it's being recycled over several years, is coming back to them as drinking water?
When people hear the story and they learn about the treatment process and how it works, they're very supportive. We've actually got no organized opposition to this project. It's very important that they understand how it works and then also where water comes from. When most people hear about how all communities in our nation and throughout the world have been using recycled water, they're very supportive because they see the level of treatment, they see the high purity water that's coming out of our plant. And they're very supportive.
Well, in fact, Orange County has been purifying sewer water since 1976. So what makes this new plant different? Is it just the size?
It's a few things. We're still using the heart of the process, which is reverse osmosis. That's what actually takes the minerals out of water. It's the same process used in ocean water desalination. But what's new here is we've improved on the processes. We've used up-to-date technology, and we're increasing the size greatly. So now we're going to be producing enough water for almost 500,000 people a year.
We understand when you talk about this process, it's forced through thin, porous membranes at high pressure. This is all while it's in, the plant or is being treated. Now, how is it further cleansed?
There's three major processes. The first is called microfiltration, and that gets the water ready for the reverse osmosis. This is basically a filtration process that removes the bacteria and protozoa in the water. The reverse osmosis, which is the heart of the process, is actually taking the dissolved matter or salts or minerals out of the water. The final step is an ultraviolet light with hydrogen peroxide. So not only does it disinfect the water, but it helps oxidize any organics that may slip through the RO. We've actually treated the water so well that at the end we have to put minerals back in, similar to the way bottled water companies do. just to make sure that the water is not corrosive.
In fact, we were going to ask if the plant was up and running, but has that become sort of a little bit of a stumbling block, that the water is too clean?
That's actually the case right now. We've been producing water for the last week, and the water actually is too low in salts. And so what we're doing is working on the mineral adding system at the very back end of the plant and making sure that works. And once that's up and running, we'll be able to put this water in the ground.
So the water is then injected into the ground, into the aquifers. It's there for quite a while. Where does it go from the aquifers? Just explain that process.
After it's in the ground for at least a year, the cities that sit on top of our groundwater basin all own drinking water wells. And so they'll pump the water out of the ground. And at that time, they would send it to their distribution system, where it would go to the residences.
How is this different from what's been known as gray water, recycled water that's been used in, you know, watering plants and in industrial use?
Gray water, or that level of treatment water, doesn't meet drinking water standards. The difference is our project, once we go through this reverse osmosis, we're actually producing a near distilled quality. It exceeds all drinking water standards, and it can be consumed. However, at that point, we actually put it in the ground. So that's the difference between our water and gray water.
Right. Well, there are those who are still, despite, you know, hearing the process, worried about health concerns, but there are some who also worry about the expense. We just heard the whole process that this water goes through. A spokesperson from the mayor of San Diego says it's one of the most expensive kinds of water you can create. He vetoed a plan to bolster the drinking water reservoir with recycled sewer water. The city council had approved this plan, and the mayor overrode it. It's a very active story. The city council may override the mayor again. But, you know, there are people who say it's just too expensive. This is, you know, over $400 million plant you're talking about.
Cost is a big concern to us, so we're very conscious of that. However, if you compare the cost to our alternative supplies, it's actually very competitive. Right now, we rely on imported water to supplement our water supply. And to produce this high-quality, near-distilled water, it's actually less cost than importing it here. And also from an environmental standpoint, we actually use half the energy when compared to importing water from Northern California here. So there's a lot of benefits that even result in cost.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if the fact that you are in Orange County makes you guys a little bit different, because another effect of injecting this water into the ground is that it holds back the seawater, which is a problem there. Explain that.
That's a great point. And the Water Factory 21 at Orange County Water District has been doing this since 1976. We've been taking this already treated wastewater that's normally discharged to the ocean, sending it through reverse osmosis, and actually injecting it in the ground along the coast. What that enables us to do is to manage our groundwater basin inland while we're pushing seawater out with basically an underground dam of clean water. And that's why our partner, Orange County Sanitation District, is also benefiting from this project, because we're recycling so much of this water and purifying it. They're deferred on constructing another ocean outfall. So the environmentalists, the surf riders, the coast keepers are all very supportive, because we are reducing the amount of water that's discharged into the ocean.
Well, Savaji Deshmukh, again, project manager for the Orange County Water District. They're about to put online the world's largest plant devoted to purifying sewer water to increase drinking water. You said that the first batch you've been working with is almost too clean. You have to put some minerals back in it. But do you drink the water? Have you had a sip of it?
I have tasted it. And because it's so free of minerals, it actually tastes flat.
Water can taste flat.
Water can taste flat.
Huh.
It's similar to the taste if you bought the distilled water from the store. It's that same quality of water.
And so you're obviously not afraid of it.
Nope. Yeah. Not at all.
Savaji, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, a quick heads up on a story we're going to have for you later in the week. Mega record producer, singer-songwriter Babyface Edmonds will be here. He has a new CD of his old favorite songs. You're listening to Here and Now. At this time of year, when we're sending cards and packages to friends and loved ones, we're especially dependent on one group of people, mail carriers, people who come to our homes every day. And we might know their names, but their stories are largely untold. Well, that's about to change thanks to our next two guests who are compiling a book about mail carriers. Kate Drury is a mail carrier in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Lois Hill was a carrier briefly. You say you come from a postal family.
Yes, I do. A blue-collar family.
Well, she's now a retired elementary school teacher. The two friends are looking for stories from mail carriers. Tell us, what is it that you think that people don't know about carriers and that made you want to write this book?
I think basically this book is going to be a celebration of letter carriers. We've been doing this since the 1800s. We're the only organization that goes to every house in America 6 days a week. I don't know about you, Robin, but I remember growing up in New Jersey, and there was the milkman, the breadman, the bakery, the dry cleaners, the postman.
The knife sharpener?
Exactly.
Everybody who came.
You know, right now, we're the last one that does that, and it's a unique job, and carriers who do it are very enthusiastic. They love the job. They care about their customers, and we want to celebrate that through their stories.
Lois, what's your sense of, you know, the most important thing a mail carrier does?
We're the ones who actually put the mail in your mailbox or in your hand, and the children and the elderly love to see us coming.
And it's connection.
It's exactly. That's the word. We're the final connection between people.
You know, I imagine, too, that when neighborhoods start to go, if there's foreclosures, you're the first to see that.
Mm. Oh, yes. We see a lot about people. In fact, as Lois said in her essay, A Day in the Life of a Letter Carrier, her opening paragraph I loved because it said, "You know, you don't know me, but I know everything about you. I know where you bank, what church you go to, what political persuasion you are, what your kids' names are, where they go to school." So it's a very responsible job, and carriers do take that trust very, very seriously.
Well, and yet there's also, you know, the hardship of being the mail carrier. We all know, I mean, the dogs, the weather. Give us a story that you're hearing from people about, you know, that side of being a mail carrier.
We have a story from 1955. A retiree sent in a story of his very first day on the job. He got attacked by a dog, and he pulled out his pepper spray and sprayed it. And as he says in his story, there's always one thing you never account for, and that was the wind. And it blew right back into his face. And for 5 minutes, his eyes were tearing, and he couldn't even see. There's a million stories like that.
Lois, what else are you hearing from letter carriers?
We're hearing about people being delighted to see women carriers, for example.
But that's not always true, because you wrote about in your one year.
Yes.
What did people say to you?
Oh, I remember a man saying, "Can you tell me why women are trying to take over the post office?" And I was speechless, because I certainly wasn't trying to take over the post office. I was just trying to earn a paycheck.
Neither rain nor hail nor sleet nor snow nor heat of day nor dark of night shall keep this carrier from the swift completion of his appointed rounds. It was said in 500 B.C. by Herodotus. Is it taken seriously by the male people today?
Definitely, now? Definitely. We're out there in the dark of night, in the heat of the summer. In fact, we're looking forward to getting some stories from Alaska. What's it like delivering mail when it's dark all day?
And stories from carriers who are working in places like where Katrina hit and the California fires, and how they were the first ones back in the neighborhoods, bringing a sense of normalcy, even more meaningful than the quote that you thoughtfully added was this saying that's inscribed at the National Postal Museum at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. "Messenger of sympathy and love, servant of parted friends, consoler of the lonely, bond of the scattered family, enlarger of the common life." Now that's a letter carrier.
That's Lois Hill. She's a former letter carrier. Kate Drury still delivers the mail in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Together, they're collecting stories about mailmen and women across the nation. To link to them, go to our website, here-now.org. They're also looking for cartoons or pictures of odd mailboxes. Proceeds from their book will benefit the Postal Employee Relief Fund. Kate, Lois, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, and tomorrow, how green is your Christmas tree? And how do you measure that anyway? That's tomorrow, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Nick Drake had already been dead for 26 years when he had his first hit song. It was showcased on a Volkswagen commercial.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way.
That song, Pink Moon, sparked a revival for the painfully shy British songwriter Nick Drake, who descended into mental illness either caused by or masked by drug use, and produced only three albums before dying in 1974 at the age of 26, possibly from a drug-induced suicide. Well, the interest in Nick Drake just continues to grow. Today, a new box set, Fruit Tree, is being released. It contains all three of his albums, plus a BBC documentary on his life. Earlier this year, we spoke with author Trevor Dann, a longtime fan of Nick Drake's, as well as the former head of BBC Music Entertainment. In his book, Darker Than the Deepest Sea, The Search for Nick Drake, Trevor seemed to document every step of the tall, lanky, increasingly shadowy figure of Nick before he disappeared from view. It was so interesting to read this because Nick Drake left so little on the record. He played few live shows. He gave just one interview to the British press. So you talked to his school friends, his remaining sister, other musicians. Give us the outline of who Nick Drake is and how they started to color it in for you.
Do you know, he's the anti-pop star, because most pop stars make it very quickly and then spend a long time unknown. And Nick Drake has spent a long time unknown and then become very successful long after his death.
Right.
He was a shadowy figure in his own life, and as such was quite interesting to research, because people who knew him in one area of his life didn't know his other friends. When he died and a few people got together for his funeral, many of them didn't know that each other were friends of his. He was a guy who compartmentalized his life, kept people away from each other and away from him.
Your title is Darker Than the Deepest Sea. It's a lyric that you take from his song, Place to Be. Let's listen.
When I was green, greener. Where flowers grow and the sun shines still. Now I'm darker than the deepest sea. Just hand me down, give me a place to be.
One of the descriptions of Nick's songs in the book comes from Robin Hitchcock, the rock and roller, who described Nick Drake's songs like butterflies attached to anchors.
Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah, it really was. What were the anchors?
I think what Robin is getting at is that there's some really deep, primal stuff going on in Nick's lyrics, although the sound of them is a sort of filigree butterfly floating sort of noise. And I think it's the contrast between the deep and the flowing that makes them so beautiful.
Well, you know, he was despondent that he didn't become a star faster. Musicians seemed to love him. So what was it? I mean, if you had to sum it up, having written the whole book, what happened? How come he didn't become a star sooner?
I think he was very badly damaged by a lot of bad luck in marketing. You know, his records, each one of them came out when there was a postal strike or when, for some reason, the marketing didn't work. But also, of course, he didn't promote them. He wouldn't go out. He was too shy. He played half a dozen gigs in his life and was no good at it. And that hurt him very deeply. This is in the days when albums came out and nobody promoted the singles. So not enough people, quite simply, heard it, and he that made him very cross.
Well, Drake was recognized and loved by other musicians. Here's the song Fly that Drake recorded with John Cale of the Velvet Underground on viola and harpsichord.
Please tell me your second name. Please play me your second game. Fallen so far for the people you are. I just need your star for a day.
You have a theory about what happened to Nick Drake. He smoked, as you write, industrial quantities of cannabis. These huge amounts of marijuana might have, what, provoked a psychosis?
I found out that prolonged exposure to that amount of cannabis has been proved over several years now that it can produce an effect that is virtually schizophrenia.
Well, we should say we did some research ourselves, and there have been recent reports saying that this huge amount of cannabis may, in fact, provoke mental illnesses. Others say it's hooey. Either way, as you said, it's so sad because nobody caught it.
No, and, you know, during this period, not many people liked him. You know, he was a bit of a spoilt rich kid by this point, and the world owed him a living, and it wasn't giving him a living. He didn't wash, he didn't cut his fingernails, he turned into a kind of Howard Hughes. He was not a lot of fun to be with. And when it was announced that he died in his record company, Island Records, several people stood up and cheered because he'd been such a damn nuisance when they were trying to promote him and make him famous. So, you know, this is not a story of a beautiful boy who, you know, who was badly treated by the world. You know, he did bring a lot of this on himself.
It's funny because that is part of the mythology, that he was just too fragile for this world.
Yeah. You know, if you get on the old websites and you find all these mad Dracophiles who are now all over the world, you know, the view is, well, he's an angel. I don't buy that. I think he made some simply gorgeous records, but I don't buy the idea that he was the son of God.
On the other hand, is there somewhere down the middle where maybe he wasn't just an arrogant rich kid who self-destructed, but maybe he was a very fragile young man wrestling with mental illness, and, you know, more true than the fact that he was angelic, but equally sad.
It's a tragic tale because, you know, like all good tragedies, it is, you know, the roots of his destruction are in himself. But none of this should take away from the fact that he wrote some words and put them together with some melodies which have proved to be completely timeless. That's a tremendous accolade, a great thing to say about any artist.
Well, Nick Drake spent his last night at his parents' home reading Camus' Myth of Sisyphus, listening to Bach's Brandenburg Concerto, and throwing back sleeping pills, too many, it turns out. Do you think he killed himself?
I think the chances are that he did. I think his sister always says that he probably just did it to see. I think he was at the end of his tether. My best guess is that it's a mixture of I can't go on with this, but also I think he may simply have taken too many. These were antidepressants more than sleeping pills, and they'd been given to him in a different dose. He was used to taking smaller tablets. They gave him bigger ones. He took as many of those as he should have done of the other ones. So I think it's probably a mixture. And, you know, in a way, it all adds to the myth. It all adds, you know, I think one of the interesting things about the book is you can make your own mind up. And when people review it and say, well, he never says really whether he committed suicide or not, I always say, well, you know, it's a bit like a novel. You decide.
Author Trevor Dann speaking about his book Darker Than the Deepest Sea, The Search for Nick Drake. The new box set of Nick Drake's work, Fruit Tree, is in stores today. We leave you with his cello song and the thought that Nick Drake's music gets the most response of any music that we use on Here and Now, and we use it often. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Strange face with your eyes, so pale and sincere, underneath, you know well, you have nothing to fear, for the dreams that came.